This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. This is Steven Siegel, your host at the New Books Network and New Books in History. And today we're joined by Professor David R. Marples, who is a distinguished university professor of Russian and East European history at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Professor Marples will be talking to us today about his new memoir. This is a book called Understanding Ukraine and Belarus, a memoir published by E-International Relations Publishing in 2020. David is the author of 16 single-authored books, including this one, Ukraine in Conflict, 2017, Our Glorious Past, Lukashenko's Belarus and the Great Patriotic War, 2014, and Heroes and Villains, Creating National History in Contemporary Ukraine, 2008. He's published over 100 articles in peer-reviewed journals, and he's also edited 4 books on nuclear power and security in the former Soviet Union, contemporary Belarus, and Ukraine. So thanks, David, for being our guest on the podcast today.
That's my pleasure.
I want to start not with a hot take on Belarus. I think we can talk about that later if you'd like, but with this story of you since your birth in 1952, what was it that motivated you to write an academic memoir?
I'm not sure what the exact motivation was, but I was thinking during the pandemic, which started here in Canada, well, early March, but in Japan, I was in Japan in February, and it was already in effect then. And it seemed like a good time to write a memoir. I had time. The university was closed. I was still on leave. I was on leave for the second 6 months of a year's leave. And it seemed an opportune time. I could no longer go to Belarus, where I'd planned to go and do research. So for once, I had time on my hands. And started to write it. I mean, I didn't know whether I'd actually finish it or not, but it seemed to take on a life of its own. And before long, I had, 50,000 words or so written. And then I just simply thought, well, I might as well keep going and finish the whole thing. Although, I hadn't really got a set structure in mind other than chronological, but it seemed to work out all right. It seemed to work out quite easily. And I felt generally satisfied, when I finished it.
David, from people who follow your work, and there are many who've tracked your career, both on Ukraine and Belarus since the 1980s and even before that, that people are curious about you, I would say, as an outsider and an insider. And for those of us who are practitioners in the field, we know that there's always an occupational hazard in being both insiders and outsiders. And we get asked a lot of questions about our lives, what our family background is. And sometimes it seems almost like a KGB method that there's a biographical and somehow biological inquiry into who we are and why we got interested in it. So how, I guess this is a long way of asking you, what made you come to the subject of Soviet studies and eventually Ukraine and Belarus?
Yes, I think initially I was at the University of London as an undergraduate. And I was studying history. I did 9 courses in history. I mean, the British system is very different from the North American one. And we just do one subject area, and that for me was history. So you cover the whole spectrum. I did all British history from medieval times to the present, 3 courses on European history, a special subject on revolt of the Netherlands, and another special subject on Nazi Germany. And I was looking for the last course. And for the last course, I decided to do a course on Russian history in University of London at the Slavic and East European Studies Center. There were several lecturers there who offered that. And I chose that one. Even though there were no formal lectures at that time, Professor Martin McCauley, who was there, offered to teach that course. And I think that kind of started me off. I mean, there's a linked reason in that I was, at the time, interested in left-wing politics. My university was in an environment where the British National Front was quite a prominent force. And I found myself at night having long arguments with people about politics and felt that sometimes, you know, the communist line was the safest one to take in terms of countering these arguments. So I was interested in communism. I was interested in left-wing politics. And at the same time, I was taking this fascinating course in central London. My college, by the way, was in the Hampstead region in the northwest, so I had to travel into London to take this course. I, of course, soon got disillusioned with the Soviet style of communism. I mean, there were too many things in there that disturbed me. But nevertheless, the interest persisted. And when I got my undergraduate degree, I moved to Sheffield to work with a man called Everett Jacobs. And Everett was originally from Boston, from a Jewish family in Boston. And he'd moved to England to take up a job in Sheffield. And he had been looking at Moldova, or Moldavia, I think he called it then. And he was particularly interested in collective farming after World War II in Moldova. And he told me, you know, this area was very interesting. And in Ukraine, right next door, of course, it was even more fascinating. There were a lot of things going on there that needed researching. He also suggested that for doing a PhD, it would be better to do a topic that was not focused on Russia. He said there were too many purely Russian specialists in the UK at that time. So when I was looking for a job, it might be difficult to get one if I'd focus purely on Russia. So for those reasons, I decided to focus on Ukraine. And it didn't really make much difference in that first year, because all I did was Russian language instruction anyway. It was sort of an intensive Russian year, starting from scratch. But what it meant was that I had to pick up a Ukrainian language instructor as well. And in Sheffield, there happened to be one, you know, there who was visiting from Kiev, who used to give me all the communist propaganda to translate. And that's kind of how I got started. So it's in a roundabout fashion. You know, I'd never really thought about a career in this area. And you were talking about background earlier. My background, unfortunately, is extremely boring. I couldn't find anything other than English in there. as my Ukrainian friends used to say, he doesn't have a drop of Slavic blood in him. But, you know, he's interested in this area. So that's how I got started, you know, and it's, you know, irony in a way, you know, a Jewish guy from Boston teaching, suggesting I do Ukrainian history. Strictly speaking, it was economic and social history because that was the department I was in. And he was more inclined towards economics, I would say, than history. But yeah, that's how I got beginning.
Yeah, no, that's a great start. And I was thinking a lot about labor politics and the British Communist Party as well. You mentioned the far right. Do you think that your own family background, you do mention your descent from a family of coal miners, had any, I would say, any cause, I guess? Was there any reason why you drifted into labor history and labor politics and moved into Eastern Europe? Was there a connection from there into your proposed thesis on Soviet collectivization, or was it a purely intellectual choice?
Well, maybe I thought it was an intellectual choice, but subconsciously there could have been something there. You know, both my grandfathers, as you say, were coal miners. They both got badly injured in coal mines, at which they'd been working from the age of 12 or 13. In fact, my maternal grandfather was so badly injured, he had to stop work in his 50s. My paternal grandfather had been at work since about 12 or 13. He had a skilled labor job, so he was quite employable, let's say. He had a decent wage, but he had a really rough time. And I could see all the injuries that he got and the conditions that were in place in the coal mines. And in Britain, the coal miners were increasingly militant from the 70s, maybe even late 60s, 70s. This was the time of the Heath Conservative government, and the coal miners were on strike several times in that period. A most decisive strike, I think, in around 73, 74, that actually probably brought down the Heath government. I think it was the decisive event. And then later, of course, they were full-scale warfare with the Thatcher government. But that was after I'd left the UK. So I think, yeah, there was something there. But I wasn't politically active prior to university. I voted Labour when I could vote. But in the next election, I voted Liberal. So it wasn't like I was particularly consistent, even being on the left. And yet, you know, this is the area I chose to go to, the Soviet communism, which is the most extreme form, I would say. And, you know, they were, in a way, quite persuasive for a brief time when I was naive. And I didn't join any political parties ever, but I was very concerned about the National Front, which were openly propagating Hitler as a kind of icon. And to have some people from there in my own college was a bit disturbing. And I reacted against something, I would say, rather than for something. You know, to me, this was obviously wrong, but I needed more ammunition. And therefore, I went the other way.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think about the transformation that a lot of intellectuals had in the 1970s. So what I find fascinating about your memoir is a transformation in just a short amount of time. You talk about not leaving the UK, if I'm correct, until really 1970, and then you discovered North America. So how do you measure your progress, if you can call it that, from the beginning to the end of the decade in the 1970s?
Yeah, in 1970 itself, my geography master in my school organized a trip to Arctic Norway. And this was the first time I'd ever really left home. I was 17 at the time, and we went to a very distant region on the Swedish border and stayed upon the ice cap there for about a month and a half, I seem to remember. I don't know the exact time period now. And that was really enervating for me. I really enjoyed that. And it wasn't like I didn't like to move out of the house or anything like that, but I hadn't been abroad. And by 1973, because my girlfriend of the time was studying Spanish, I spent time in Spain. And in 74, we went on a big trip around Europe using youth hostels and, you know, living in a fairly modest, I would say, abode and with very little money. And after that, I think I kind of caught the bug. But the trip to North America was more or less enforced by the fact that I was not allowed to go to the Soviet Union. I won a British Council scholarship to go to the Soviet Union in 1976, I think it was, but I was maybe 1977, but I was not allowed to travel because my topic, Western Ukraine after World War II, was too sensitive for the Soviet side. And the way they stopped me going was simply to put some nuclear physicist on their list who they knew the British would turn down. Right. And then they turned me down. And of the six people on the British list, I was the only one who was permanently rejected. And I was told I would never get there with that topic. I wasn't going to change the topic. So my supervisor suggested, well, you know, in the United States, we've got more resources for Ukraine in this period than we have in Britain. I mean, I did try to find some contacts in Britain, and I found quite a few at the local clubs, Ukrainian clubs, as you can imagine, who had left after World War II, who were quite willing to talk to me. I also met Professor Ivan Korepetsky, a professor from Temple University in Philadelphia, who was staying in London by chance and agreed to see me. And we had a long chat, and he said, you know, well, come on over. You can stay at my place for a while until we get you settled. And then you can go to Washington and you can do things more seriously. And that worked out amazingly easily. He was a wonderful host, and he introduced me to a lot of people in the Ukrainian community and in the Ukrainian academic world. And after that, I simply made a list of people who I needed to visit on this month-long trip to United States. Four-month-long trip to United States. That would be between January and April 1978. And at that time, you could buy a Greyhound bus pass for $99. I don't know what they cost now. But I got one of those and traveled all over the place, actually. I not only, you know, did academic stuff, which I put in the book, but I went to visit some friends I'd met as well. I stayed a night in Louisville, for example. I went to watch a Tubes concert in Minneapolis during the bus stopover. And, you know, all kinds of adventures like that. But I got around. I got around. And this is how I kind of got started. And the Ukrainian community in Washington was amazingly hospitable. Probably because they found someone interested in Ukraine, which at that time was unusual. And in the Library of Congress, Yuri Dobchansky, the Slavic bibliographer, was that time about 25. He and I became good friends, and he actually would take me down to the stacks and say, find what you want and take as long as you want, and then you can go back to the desk and work on it. So I didn't even have to order books once I got to know him. And that made life much simpler. But that was the way my PhD began.
Yeah, I'm struck by your mental map of North America. You seem to have boarded the Greyhound bus with a mental map of the location for major scholars in the Ukrainian immigrant community, and just like made a beeline toward them. And that's so interesting. It's actually, for better or worse, what I tell my graduate students sometimes to do. But I want to ask about some of these names and characters, because you have such a wonderful insight knowledge of them through your first impressions. So could you tell us a little bit about Ivan Lisiak Rudnitsky and, for that matter, Manoli Lupul as well, and what kind of experiences you had initially with them? You mentioned how Rudnitsky introduced you to a shaggy-haired John Paul Himka, who was still in his 20s at that point, and you know, probably a Detroit leftist still at that moment. But how did you then follow through and have conversations with some of these Ukrainian emigre figures?
Well, Ivan Rudnitsky, he had invited me to go to Edmonton while I was on this bus trip. And I had no idea where Edmonton even was, to be perfectly frank. I didn't even know where it was. I'd only seen a distant clip when some space capsule landed in Arctic Canada, and some guy was reporting from Edmonton in a snow blizzard. And I watched that in Washington, D.C., where you can imagine, you know, that I could hardly believe that that's where I was supposed to go. And Ivan picked me up when I arrived in Edmonton, and he told me I could stay at his house for 4 days, very precise, 4 days. He was a small, compact little guy. He had a wonderful accent, and I always wondered whether he cultivated this English accent. It was, you know, clearly intellectual, cultured accent, but at the same time, you could tell he was from Eastern Europe. And he was married to a woman called Alexandra Chernenko, who was a local poet. And she was a very, I don't know how you describe her without being rude, but a kind of pushy figure. You know, she was the one who would initiate conversation. She would demand answers to questions, whereas Ivan was more laid back, would be the word I would use. He was very quiet spoken, polite in conversation. He would draw you gradually into the things in which he was interested. And he had a fascinating range of areas that he looked at. He wasn't just a Ukrainian specialist, you know, he was interested in 1,000 things, a real intellectual in many ways. But like people who are so talented and of so many different diverse interests, he never focused particularly on getting stuff done. You know, he had many, many projects that he left unfinished.
He had 2,000 pages or something like that in his private writings, right?
Yes, he put things into his private writings. And he'd written a book. You know, he'd written one book, but his sort of acolyte put it together and published it. And Ivan worked with Lupul. Lupul was the director of the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies, which had been formed in 76. So this was March 78. So it was a relatively new institution. It was in a building called Athabasca Hall, one of the older buildings in the University of Alberta. Beautiful building. And I met them both together. I mean, I met Rudnitsky first. He took me to see Lupul. So I met him in Lupul's office. And Lupul was a very different personality. Rudnitsky was a European-born Ukrainian. Lupul was an Alberta-born Ukrainian. And there's a big difference between the two. Lupul was not a Ukrainian speaker. He was a very serious man. He spoke in sort of staccato language, you know, very staccato phrases, awkwardly. Didn't seem very comfortable in anybody's presence, and yet was very sincere. And Lupul was, I think, a controversial figure in the Ukrainian community because he used to get into fights with everybody about different things. But he was totally committed to the Ukrainian cause. But at the same time, he was totally committed to the Canadian one too. So the two of them combined together. He wanted a stronger Canada, but he wanted Ukrainians as part of that Canada, a very integral part of it. He felt they deserved that. They'd been there from the 1890s. They built many of the places on the prairies, and this should be recognized. Whereas Rudnitsky was more, you know, we're the cultural figures from Europe, and these are the peasant farmers who came during the Austrian-Galician period and stayed over. So there are several generations down now. And Lupul was one of these who discovered he was Ukrainian. He was originally called Bob, you know, for example. Discovered he was Ukrainian and started learning the language and culture. It reminds me of a letter we once got to sent to the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies from a guy in the States, actually. And he said, my name is Paul Feely. I would like to learn the Ukrainian culture and language as quickly as possible. So that was exactly how Rudnitsky looked at Lupul, I would say, at the time.
I'm sorry, that's a letter that still goes around from a lot of people after Maidan. I'm a graduate student, and I'd really like to learn the Ukrainian language and culture as soon as possible.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I want to talk more about some of these characters and their personalities. You've got James Mace, you've got Bob Magochi, many of them who may not be familiar to our audience, honestly, here at New Books Network. But you also had a career really as a journalist, and that developed, I think, out of Edmonton, but you ended up working for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. I have to go back a little bit because I was going to mention that Lupul gave me a very menial position after I ended up doing a master's degree in Alberta. And after that, Lupul offered me a job. And this job was for his editorial assistant, and it was the lowest paid job in the institute. But Lupul wanted me to pay wages even lower than the university's minimum. I mean, he set me at $10,000, whereas the minimum at that time was $15,600. So he was very reluctantly had to raise the wages. But after 4 years, I mean, it was painstaking editorial work on manuscripts written in non-native English. It was the hardest work I've ever done in my life. And after about 3.5 years of this, I did start to look around. And a fellow called Roman Solchanik, another Michigan graduate, actually, was a research analyst at Radio Liberty in Munich. And he said he was looking for another position on the Ukrainian research desk. And would I be interested? So I went for an interview in Munich at the English Garden, where the Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe were at that time. Beautiful setting, but it was in a former psychiatric hospital, so it was a kind of strange building. High security, with big imposing guards at the entrance and these metal gates that clang back and forth as you went in, and then you had to go through a second security to get into the building. And the security put me off a little bit, but the wages were astronomical by my standards at that time. And I was offered, you know, to pay my way, to take my wife and young son over as well, and to provide housing. I mean, everything was set up for me. So I took this job, and I was my position was to write Ukrainian research papers on the economy and on society and on energy issues, because Roman Solchanik, he wrote on national question, religion, he wrote on politics.
He was a Sporluk student, right? Wasn't he a student of Roman Sporluk?
Yeah, like Himke, he was a Sporluk student. And he was a very good scholar, no question at all. He was a very good scholar, and he read everything. He also smoked like a chimney, these Camel cigarettes. So as I put in the book, the first thing I did when I got to the office, it was a big office in Munich, was to buy a massive fan and place it facing his desk so that the smoke went back to him. But the whole room was completely full of newspapers and Ukrainian newspapers that you could order from Radio Liberty. He ordered the lot, as well as all the journals, and they were just piled up all around the floor. So they reached around the corner and into my area. So I started promptly filling up with the newspapers that I ordered and the books that I brought with me. So it was a pretty full office. And Roman was a brusque character. If you want to know what his accent was like, it's a little bit like Trump's accent. If you imagine Trump as an intellectual, Roman's, I don't say he's got the politics.
I can't, David. I just can't.
that's the kind of accent Roman had. And a very, very amusing guy. He had a lot of stories. And a wonderful New Zealand wife who sort of kept him balanced, I think. You know, my family and Roman's family and the family of Bogdan Mihailo, another figure who was there at the time, came from Amnesty International and had worked at The Spectator. He was in charge of the Ukrainian, initially foreign policy, but he actually moved to the Ukrainian desk itself and became the director of the Ukrainian program. So the three of us used to hang around quite a lot, and we were all very different personalities from very different backgrounds. Although Bogdan and I had the... We both were from Northern England, so we had that in common. But it was an interesting environment there because you had every nationality in the Soviet Union was represented in Radio Liberty, and they all used to have their own little cliques. Some wouldn't speak to the other. So they used to meet in the canteen down in the basement in the mornings and order breakfast. And some of the conversations were really, really entertaining. Others I simply couldn't understand because I didn't understand what languages they were speaking. But the Poles wouldn't sit with the Russians. The Azeris wouldn't sit with the Armenians. And woe be tied if you move to the wrong table, because I was supposed to sit with the Ukrainians, right?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. Well, my feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, because this is really a generation or maybe two before me, but there were so many people who were working intelligence in that environment, both CIA and KGB. And it was, you had inclinations and sensibilities and feelings about who was doing what, but did you actually know at this time? Because this was around the time that you were getting involved with the whole Chernobyl situation. That's another story. But these are two questions. I mean, one is about RFERL, and the other is about your eventual discovery of Chernobyl and how you got in.
Yeah, I mean, I got back to Canada before Chernobyl took place, but I was working on nuclear energy when I was at Radio Liberty. And yeah, I would say that he had a vague idea that people might be CIA or they might be KGB. The KGB ones were much more difficult to discern, you know, and you usually found out after the fact, you know, after they defected back to the Soviet Union. Then you thought, oh, well, I kind of thought you might be KGB all the time, but you actually weren't sure. Whereas the CIA were a little bit more obvious. Usually they were native English speakers, for one. I wouldn't say that's always the case, but many, those that I knew were. They were okay. I mean, it wasn't as if it was run by the CIA, and it didn't actually affect much that I wrote. I mean, the guy I dealt with, John Erickson, was a professor from Bowling Green University in Ohio, I think it is. And he was a really easygoing guy. He used to let you do more or less what you want. There was Keith Bush as head of the Radio Liberty Research Unit. He was an economist, sort of Santer's type guy. Found him a little bit hard going at times, but you know, he had to deal with him regularly. So it was a kind of mixture of people, the nationalities who worked mostly on the desk doing language stuff. They were simply translating stuff into their own language and broadcasting back.
Right.
And the problem for me was you couldn't really check what happened to your script once it went up to the program desk, how it was broadcast. You didn't often get copies back. And if you did, you didn't really have time to read them because you were swamped with other stuff. But I got into nuclear energy because it seemed to me something that was really growing in Ukraine. So when I got back to Canada at the end of 1985, early 1986, this was an area I'd covered quite a lot. So when Chernobyl happened in late April, I'd sort of got a good background, you know, and I was one of the few people in North America who even knew where it was at the time. And even though I was relatively young, early 30s, I was swamped by media attention for, I would say, about a period of 3 to 5 months, somewhere around that. But especially in the period around early May to the end of June, you know, that period where it was almost constant interviews and writing editorials. And I was persuaded, you know, to start my first book because of that. And the director of CIUS, the Institute of Ukrainian Studies, was by then Bogdan Kravchenko. He'd taken over from Lupul, who'd retired. And Bogdan, another fascinating character, by the way, we used to call him Captain Ukraine. And he,
yeah, I could see that. Yes,
he was extremely enthusiastic, and he said, "David, you've got to write a book on this. You're the only one who could do this. Write a book on this. You can take all the time you want. You can give all the equipment you need. Just do it." And I had the freedom over the next 3 months just to do this, shut myself away, and worked on stuff that many of the sources I got. Roman Solchanik was sending me from Munich. You know, he was just piling on sources, and I use these in the book as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, can I ask? So you wrote that book really pretty fast, didn't you? And I mean, in terms of the sources you used, so were there things that you would change or that you would do over if you had more time and more resources at that point?
Well, the book is mainly background. You could have called it a history of nuclear power in Ukraine, except for the last chapter where I added a bit about Chernobyl. So it was a complete background book. And as such, I think it served its purpose. The problem was that I was very angry when I was writing it. And it was one of those things you get mad at the Soviet regime for its secrecy and not telling people what happened
sure.
around them. I mean, sure. I kind of learned since that time that that's the case when there's a nuclear accident anyway. People don't like to tell all the information immediately to the population around. But as a young scholar, I felt that, you know, I had a story to tell and it needed telling. But even though when I'd finished it, I thought I was still gathering stuff more and more and more. And I realized that I needed to do a book that was solely on Chernobyl. And that's why I was working on this book that eventually got called The Social Impact of the Chernobyl Disaster. And I worked together with a PhD student, actually from Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania, Lida Hefke, who was a biomedical engineer, but was fluent in Ukrainian and Russian. She was Ukrainian background. And she came up to Edmonton for a couple of months. And I had a grant, actually, from the Ukrainian National Association. It's been a critique that's been sent in my direction that I took this grant because of the political nature of the organization. But I took this grant, and it enabled me to hire her, you know, pay for a housing or whatever for that period. So together we went through all the sources.
Right.
And I wrote that second book, which is a better book, I think, in every respect than the first one. But I also started going around nuclear power stations in Canada and talking to nuclear engineers at Atomic Energy of Canada about how Chernobyl had happened. And one of them wrote the introduction for that book based on the Canadian scenario at the time. But keep in mind, I've still not been to the Soviet Union because I couldn't get in.
Yeah. And as a
former, you know, employee of Radio Liberty, it was not that easy to get in. But I asked to go. But, you know, I didn't get there until to write about Chernobyl until 1989. So that was kind of late.
Yeah. And so, I mean, how did you, we've been talking a lot about Ukraine, and I could ask you 100 more questions about Ukraine and Chernobyl. But was Chernobyl the way or the avenue to Belarus for you? Was this through the Chernobyl, Children of Chernobyl congresses? And I mean, the many, many talks that you were invited to give between, say, 1987 and 1991, was that how you eventually ended up in Minsk and in Belarus? Because, I mean, you do talk about the opposition and all of that, but you didn't visit Belarus until after the collapse of the Soviet Union, right?
That's right. I'd been to the Soviet Union, I think, about 4 times by then, and always to either Moscow, Leningrad, Kiev, but I hadn't been to Belarus. And in 91, in the spring, it was the 5th anniversary of Chernobyl. And, you know, once again, I was in Washington, which seems to crop up all the time in my memoir. And I was there to give talks to different institutions. And I think the main one was for the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown. But I was also invited by an anti-nuclear group to give a talk for them. And they were really sort of hippies, bare feet, sandals type group with slogans, you know. And I didn't put this in the book, but, you know, the talk I gave for them, I wasn't the main speaker, but I was like the second main speaker. The main one was someone who was really well known in the anti-nuclear world. But I was watching these speakers and I noticed that, you know, they had to say something provocative. And here was myself with this carefully academic style speech on Chernobyl and I realized it was not going to work. So after a while, I just got up one after another, described the nuclear plants that had been closed in the Soviet Union. And I got a standing ovation after each one I announced. You know, so this is the kind of atmosphere we created. And then we had a reception afterwards. And at the reception, I met some people from Belarus. And one was a guy called Yuri Pankratz. And he was with a group called Children of Chernobyl, as you mentioned. And he said, why are you writing all this stuff on Ukraine? You know, in Belarus, the impact of Chernobyl was worse. And we'd like to invite you here to our next meeting, our next conference on Belarus in April of 1992. So it would have been a year later. So that's when I first went to Belarus. And I went to this Children of Chernobyl Congress. And it was very different from Ukraine. I mean, in Ukraine, by this time, there was a lot of activity. There was a Green World Movement. Anti-nuclear activity, the RUC was very prominent. Belarus was like a graveyard compared to Ukraine. I mean, nothing much was there. Very few cars on the streets, Soviet monuments everywhere. And yet, you had an independent state. You know, the state had just become independent. Stanislav Shushkevich was the chairman of the parliament. He was the main position. Not very stable, but he was in the main position. So I went there before Lukashenko. And I got fascinated not only by Chernobyl, but also by the history. And that's why I wrote my first book was a combination of the two. It was like the history and what happened after the nuclear power accident. So I just kept going back to Belarus and I found it so interesting. And yeah. I was so much alone as a foreign scholar there, with one exception, Rainer Lindner, a guy from Germany.
He and I used to
meet up there quite regularly. And he started this Minsk dialogue, which has become very successful. But Rainer, I think, eventually went more into the business side.
He's in business. I remember as a grad student reading his Belarus book in German and thinking, well, what has happened to him? Why is he not a full professor of Belarusian history somewhere? But I was also naive at that moment in the late 90s and early 2010s. I had thought that Belarusian history would take off as much as Ukrainian history. But anyway, I did want to talk about Belarus with you, and you mentioned Lukashenko over and over again. So can we introduce him as a character to your memoirs? What was your initial impressions of him? Because he kind of came out of nowhere. And then, of course, we can have this as a political conversation about Belarus.
Yeah, he
did 30 years back now.
He did come out of nowhere. He was an acting chairman of Commission on Corruption in the Belarusian Parliament back in the early 90s. And he composed a list of about 50 people he felt should be investigated for corruption. And this came as a surprise to Belarusians. You know, they hadn't really thought about the topic that much. One of them was, in fact, Stanislav Shushkevich, who eventually had to leave office because of some trumped-up charges of embezzling state property. And Lukashenko used this as a lever to get himself noticed as a possible election candidate. And my friend at the Chernobyl Children's Program, Gennady Grushevoy, the director of it, was telling me a story about Lukashenko that when the Supreme Soviet Deputy Chairmanship was up for vacancy, the Social Democrats, of which Grushevoy was one, were sort of thinking about a candidate. And this fellow called Lukashenko kept running up to them, saying, "Choose me, choose me, choose me." But they didn't know who he was. And he was kind of ostracized, and they thought, you know, we don't need him. And then he ran for the office on this anti-corruption basis. And Vyacheslav Kebich, who was the prime minister, was another one accused of corruption. And very probably there were some issues there. And as a result, Lukashenko did win that first round. But I was there in 94 for that election. And I was hanging around the Shushkevich camp because that's where Grushevoy was. But
sure.
The other big opposition figure was Zianin Pazniak, the leader of the Popular Front. And he was felt to be the main danger by Kebich. You know, everybody was watching what he was doing. Extreme nationalist on the right, as he was called then. And nobody noticed Lukashenko coming through the back. And he won by surprise. And he won in the second round quite convincingly over Kebich. And after that, he was given a sort of 6 month grace period by the opposition to see how he got on. And after about a year, they were tired of him completely. He'd had a referendum by then. He'd changed the laws on language to push Russian forward as a state language alongside Belarusian. He changed the constitution. He'd empowered parliament, empowered the presidency over the parliament. And then in 96, you know, he went even further and got rid of the parliament, the old parliament, completely, and changed it from 260 deputies to 120, trying to make sure that only his friends were included. And it just sort of went from there. He gradually turned into a dictator. And I think even by 1999, 2000, we saw the worst of Lukashenko. I would say even worse than today, when the brutality today is reaching the same kind of level as 1999, 2000, because that was the year that he should have been re-elected again. There were no election.
That's interesting. I mean, I sometimes think of 2010 as a turning point. And you do mention this when the candidates were arrested and put into prison. These were 7 of the 9 opposition candidates. But you would maybe say there was a turning point earlier. I mean, in 2010, this is the moment that you, as the president of the Belarusian Association, get banned from Belarus for I think, yes, like 5 or 6 years. So I don't know. This is both a historical question and a personal question, because obviously you're cut off from a lot of your friends and colleagues and working professionals at that moment in 2010. So I don't remember what my question was, but it was about the turning point when Lukashenko is able to consolidate power, and maybe he's able to do that in several phases rather than just one.
Yeah, well, I think that 1998 to 2000 was his big crisis. That whole period was a crisis. And it was a crisis because he changed the constitution, and he'd also started his term in office from the time the constitution changed in 96. So that he didn't have to run for office again in 2001. But the opposition's view was that his mandate ran out in 1999, and therefore the power should devolve from the president to the chairman of the parliament. The chairman of the parliament, Simon Sharetsky, fled to Lithuania. You know, he realized what was coming. The deputy chairman, Viktor Hunchar, who had been the campaign manager of Lukashenko in 1994, was abducted off the street and was never seen again. And there were several other figures who were murdered by Lukashenko or his agents in 1999-2000. I've not seen that repeated. I mean, people have been killed in 2020 by people shooting them from a distance, but not abducted off the street in this secret fashion and murdered. But when I look back on Lukashenko's presidency, there are several incidents there that could be attributed directly to the president. Now, I wouldn't have done it at the time, but I would do it now. And one of them was the explosion in the subway in central Minsk in 2011 when several people were killed. And Lukashenko showed up there with his son about 3 hours later. And at the time, I wondered to myself, how on earth did he know that it was safe to go with this young boy? How could you possibly know unless you knew when the timing device was going to go off? And that, for me, was evidence that all of these had Lukashenko's name on them. You mentioned 2010. Yeah, 2010 was a tough time. But also 2006, of course, you had a big protest in the square, which Lukashenko said was a color revolution taking place in Belarus. Then 2010. 2015 was very quiet. And then 2020, where you have this mass grassroots upsurge, which had never happened before. So the question really is why it's so different in 2020 as opposed to these other times. And I think it's because this time you don't have traditional political parties running the opposition campaign. You have people from the elite itself who run campaigns, get arrested, and then have a surrogate in Tsikhanouskaya, who is running on behalf of her spouse, Siahi, who was in jail. And her campaign took off. I mean, her campaign with the other two women, both linked to the other campaigns, of Sakala and Babarika, her campaign simply took off because it was so appealing to the population. You have three relatively young women, not in politics at all. They're not really promising anything other than a more free environment and an end to this miserable dictatorship and ignoring the coronavirus and declining economic conditions. I mean, people are just simply sick of it. And I think that's really what has changed.
And I know you've been asked this question a lot, David, about the comparing Maidan and comparing 2020 and the falseness of comparisons. But you do have a conjunction in your memoir. It is understanding Ukraine and Belarus together. And at a moment after a lot of uprisings and revolutions in Ukraine, back to the Orange Revolution, 2004, up to Maidan and through Maidan. So if the task in 2020, and this is both a personal question since you've written an academic memoir, but if the task is saying what's happening in Ukraine or what's happening in Belarus is not what has happened in Ukraine, then where is it useful to draw those comparisons historically and otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult to make a direct comparison simply because Ukraine has been through so much compared to Belarus. I mean, Ukraine has had upheaval after upheaval from 1990. You could start in 1990, it could go early, but 1990 when you had the first so-called Maidan, the big protest in the square, which eventually got rid of the prime minister. And then 2004, the Orange Revolution, where again, protests against election results that were clearly fabricated in favor of Yanukovych. So probably the situation in Belarus is more comparable, certainly, to 2004 in Ukraine, because it is a protest against election results. But it's also different in terms of the system, I think, because Yushchenko, with all due respect, was from the establishment. And he went back to the establishment. I mean, Kuchma, who supposedly had murdered journalists and things like that, was never persecuted. You know, he was allowed a respectable retirement. He's taking place in the talks on the future of the Donbass today. And the system in Ukraine remained in place. I don't know if the system in Ukraine, in Belarus, is savable if Lukashenko goes, because he's so very much in his own image. he's taken the Constitution, he's destroyed it, and he's put in its place a new one that's really mirrored around himself as the president and the only figure who can unify Belarus. And this is the big myth that's being propagated, that Belarus is Lukashenko. And what the demonstrators are showing is, oh no, there's a very different Belarus from Lukashenko. And we don't want Lukashenko anymore. You know, we're tired of him. We'd like to have something different in its place. I would agree that there are similarities in some respects about where people want to go in the future. But there was only one source of power in Belarus. In Ukraine, there are several. And if you look at Ukraine under Zelensky, you will see that the oligarchs are still there. They're still very much entrenched.
Sure.
No one's removed them. In Belarus, there isn't. So if Lukashenko goes, there's going to be a vacuum of power. And that's a very dicey situation, no matter who takes over. And I think it will be a very interesting period in the next 5 to 10 months ahead of how this will go, because Lukashenko clearly doesn't have the full backing of Russia. He has something, but Russia is ambivalent. And I think one part of Putin's thinking is, what comes after Lukashenko? What can I do to ensure that after Lukashenko, we have someone who's going to be supportive of Russia?
Yeah.
And Tsikhanouskaya hasn't really threatened that at all. She said she respects the connections with Russia. She's not planning to do anything to break them. And I think that would have been the case with Babarika, who was the most popular candidate in the initial part of the elections. It looked like Babarika was the most popular. And he is a banker, you know, someone from the establishment, and from a bank that is prominent in Moscow, Gazprom Bank. So the question is, where would he have gone? I mean, most likely toward Russia as well. And I think that is why it's different in Belarus. Ukraine has gone in a completely different direction, or did in 2014.
Right. We began by talking about your memoir, and it's clear to me that you haven't retired. if you're writing another memoir, or if you're writing a 2020s story involving diasporas, Ukrainian, Belarusian, academics, and professional communities, what do you think will happen? I hate to ask this of historians, but it's a forecasting question. Do you see yourself further involved in Belarusian politics and Ukrainian diaspora politics in the future?
Yeah, I thought you were going to ask that question. And it's
you knew it was coming.
I knew it was coming. It's the most difficult one to answer. And I would say, in short, no, I would not get involved in Ukrainian diaspora politics. And I've had my hands burned, let's say, by dipping them into the water. You can only go so far. And at some point, I think my academic position contravened much of what the diaspora believed fundamentally true. That is that people like Bandera, Shukevich are national heroes and their background cannot be questioned. Jean-Paul Himka ran into this problem before I did. And I think one has to have some integrity as an academic and stick to what you find, no matter what the findings are. And if that turns out to be what people dislike, that's too bad. You know, it's too bad, but it doesn't mean you should change your position. And if you do, then I think you compromise your integrity. On Belarus, there are some nasty periods as well. Let's not mistake that. But the difference between Belarus and Ukraine is that the diaspora in Belarus, is very small, and B, is not so nationalistic in that many of the diaspora now are coming over now. I mean, there's more recently than there's been for a long time in Edmonton, for example. They're all recent emigres. They're not emigres from the Second World War period. So in the Ukrainian diaspora, you probably have a majority who are now sixth or seventh generation Ukrainians. They are not politically active. Let's say they don't have strong views. The strong views are coming from the minority, which goes back to the post-Second World War period. And they're the ones with strong views on these subjects that they pick up in scouting camps or wherever. It doesn't matter. But the fact is, they believe these things. And you cannot really convince them otherwise, no matter what you're going to say. So there's no point in really trying to do that. I mean, you can talk about things with the diaspora that don't have this political resonance. That's perfectly fine. And I don't think anything to do with contemporary Ukraine, for example, that I do is going to offend people in the diaspora. But if you go back in time and start talking about, you know, World War II nationalism or the Holocaust in Ukraine or things of that nature, then you might have some problems. I am very interested in the Holocaust in both Ukraine and Belarus. And in Belarus, my most recent article is on the Trastyanets death camp in Belarus, which I wrote with a Belarusian scholar. It's coming out early next year in Europe-Asia Studies. And this is a focus where it's kind of possible to do that in Belarus. And I think it is easy to work there in many respects. But
right.
I will still keep working in both fields for sure. You know, I've always sort of tried to do a project in one area, then go to the other area for the next project and so on. And occasionally doing something on Russia as well.
Right.
But
do you see yourself writing more books? I mean, would you be willing to write a book on 2020 alone or the current situation? I'm sure you will be asked if you haven't.
Yeah, I would like to write a book on what's happening now in Belarus for sure. My current project is about, this is something that's not come up at all, but it's the last chapter of the book, is about Stalinist executions in Belarus in the late 1930s. This was the current focus. And I published a new article in Slavic Review on this topic. It's relatively new for me. And I think that one is something I can pursue. Obviously, I can't do it now. And whether I can get back into Belarus at the moment is a moot point. Who knows, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, obviously, this one is a godsend, you know, for anyone who works on Belarus, that finally this upsurge of the population. How can I not write on that?
Right. And the fact that there's still a visa-free regime, which hopefully can last since 2017. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, I heard of a colleague of mine who recently got in there, you know, even like a week ago. So I think it's possible to still go and do this. And I've taken advantage of this 30-day visa-free regime and, you know, no sort of encumbrances on you at all. You don't even have to register now in hotels like you used to do. But that could change. I mean, everything could change now. As long as Lukashenko remains in power, there could be more impositions. But if there's a takeover of power, I think you could see a lot of changes in Belarus and all of them good, unless, of course, you get Russian involvement on a major scale. And that could happen too.
Yeah. And thank you, David. And on that note, I think that's a perfect way to end our podcast today in New Books in History and the New Books Network. We're featuring today David R. Marples, who is a distinguished professor of Russian and East European history. Still in Edmonton. I'm in San Diego. David is in Edmonton. David is at the University of Alberta. And he's written a wonderful memoir, which I'd recommend for anyone to read both inside and outside. It's called Understanding Ukraine and Belarus, a memoir by David R. Marples, published in 2020 by E International Relations Publishing. Thanks, David, for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, anytime, Steve. It was great. Thank you.